Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. You are listening to the Next Best Picture podcast, and this is my interview with the writer and director for Passing, Rebecca Hall.
Pardon me, I don't mean to stare, but I think I know you.
Claire?
I'm trying to find out the history of the blonde you've brought along.
She's a girl from Chicago I used to know.
Princess from Chicago.
Things aren't always what they seem.
I'll be damned. Lots of people pass all the time.
It's easy for a Negro to pass for white. I'm not sure it'd be so simple for a white person to pass for color.
So you haven't ever thought to?
What?
You ever thought of passing?
No, why should I? I have everything I've ever wanted.
This is my husband, John Bellew.
Does he
know?
But you dislike Negroes, Mr. Bellew.
No, not at all. I hate them.
Isn't she extraordinarily beautiful?
I suppose.
Your life is perfect.
Have you ever thought of what you'd do if John found out?
I'd do what I want more than anything right now. I'd come up here to live. With you.
You think they'd be satisfied being white?
Who's satisfied being anything?
Were all of us passing for something or other? Aren't we?
Hi, Rebecca.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me about your directorial debut, Passing. I'm Matt Negley. I'm with Next Best Picture. And I want to first start off by asking a question that I know myself and a lot of other members on the team over at my site have been wondering. You've had such a great career so far as an actress. Why did you feel now was the time to step in the director's chair?
Yeah, I didn't really feel now was the time. I suppose that the field has opened up a little bit, so I was allowed to be. But I don't know, it was a combination of a couple things. I mean, the truth is I've been daydreaming about being a director since I was about 7 years old. Like, it's always been the thing for me. And even from I grew up in a family that had access to the industry, not the film industry, but theater. And, you know, my father was a director and I had access to all of it. So the fact that even from that privileged position, I didn't really imagine myself doing it for so long. Mm-hmm. I feel a certain amount of sadness about that. But the truth is, it's what I've always wanted to do. And I think I've always approached acting a bit like a director. You know, I tend to like map out the whole sort of narrative arc of the movie and sit on sets imagining how it's going to cut together. And, you know, and I just sort of lied to myself and assumed that that was doing the work of acting when actually secretly I was just yearning to be a director. So
that's really, really fascinating to hear. So I imagine that on other projects that you've worked on, you must have picked up a thing or two from some of the other directors you've worked with or other people working behind the camera. Can you tell me a little bit about who was a very helpful influence for you and shared a thing or two with getting you ready for this?
You know, it's strange. I can't really cite one or two specific instances. It's more like cumulative experience of watching people work and knowing. I mean, I think the biggest lesson that I learned was there isn't really a one way to do this.
Sure.
There isn't a right way. There's only your way. And I think that, you know, ultimately, for me, there was only one way to make this movie. I only ever saw it in black and white in 4:3 with this very pared down soundscape and complex sound design. And, you know, it told in this way, told in this small sort of very claustrophobic way. I'm sure other people would make a completely different version of that book. But this was my way. And I think the luxury of experience with other directors is that you can see that everybody does it really differently and it doesn't make their results better or worse because it does boil down to your relationship with the frame. you know, mm-hmm. it's like you're sitting on set and everything else goes out the window. It's like, is what I'm looking at, is that making it sing here? Am I feeling the things that I need to feel? And if not, then I got to change something. And you keep going until you do.
I love that. And I love that you also referenced the book as well. Can you talk a little bit about what themes in Nella Larsen's book stood out to you that made you connected to the material, that you knew that this was the right story to tell?
Well, I had a giant, obvious connection to the material because my grandfather was Black and passed white for his whole life in Detroit, wow. Michigan. And so I had a very sort of explicit connection to the material. But beyond that, I personally was overwhelmed and struck by, you know, any great work of art, I think, transcends the specificity of what it's about. And mm-hmm. Nella Larsen, she takes racial passing as a metaphor and just explodes it, because it ends up not really being about the woman who's hiding her racial identity, but about the other one who isn't hiding her racial identity, but is arguably hiding everything else about herself. Mm. And so it becomes actually about how all of us negotiate identity as this place between the story that we tell the world about ourselves and the one that the world tells us about ourselves. Because all of us are dealing with tension in that. Like, and how much freedom do we have to actually express ourselves in relation to that?
It's a very, very complex theme. And it's one that, you know, you mentioned earlier, shooting this in the aspect ratio you wanted to do it in, black and white, all of these themes that you're also telling through this story. You know, I want to know, just in terms of getting the film like off the ground, you know, I it sounds like it's a hard sell, but at the same time, it sounds like your collaboration with Netflix has been nothing but supportive from what I can tell.
Oh, they've been incredible, but they bought the film out of Sundance. So we'd already made the film by the time Netflix came along.
Yeah.
And getting the financing to actually make the film was took 7 years.
That's wow. See, yeah, that's what I was getting at, like in terms of just the journey to bring this.
Every single place I took it to, and I pitched it everywhere.
Yeah.
Everybody said the same thing. And it just kind of killed me, because they'd say, wow, this is incredible. I've never heard of this book. How have I never heard of this book? It's so obviously, it's so universal and the themes are so potent. And I'd say, yeah, okay. So are you going to give me the money to make it? No, I don't think we can. No, it's too risky. It's too ambiguous. It's too, also you're a first time filmmaker and you want to make it in black and white and 4:3. Can you make it in color? No, I can't make it in color. It won't work. Okay. Well, can you change some aspects? No, I can't change aspects of the story. So on and on and on it went. And then I met Nina Yang Bon Jovi and Forest Whitaker, whose company is literally their MO is to take projects that have been said no to. and they, if it wasn't for them, it wouldn't have happened. And they were the first people I met who didn't ask me to change a thing about my vision and just said, we'll scrap it together somehow. You're going to have to make it for a lot less than you'd like, but we'll scrap it together somehow. And that's true. We did make it for a lot less than any period film should ever be made up for. But, you know, we did get it made. And I don't know, it's incredibly validating to be here at this point, because, you know, even when we did get it made and even when we were screening at Sundance, I would still hear the same thing of, wow, this film is incredible. It's so wonderful. It's so moving. Yada, yada. I don't think it's going to sell. You know, it's a bit niche. It's a bit art house. And I suppose what everyone was kind of saying but not saying is, you know, a story that centers the emotional lives of two women of color is not going to be mainstream. And I'm sitting here on the other side of that with Netflix having bought it and potentially millions of people going to see it. And it's really validating and exciting to see, actually, yes, the emotional lives of two women of color can be mainstream.
Yeah, totally.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Burn the Boats from Evergreen Podcasts. I interview political leaders and influencers, folks like award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien and conservative columnist Bill Kristol, about the choices they confront when failure is not an option. I won't agree with everyone I talk to, but I respect anyone who believes in something enough to risk everything for it. Because history belongs to those willing to burn the boats. Episodes are out every other week wherever you get your podcasts.
You mentioned before the difficulty of having the small budget. So you have to do research into New York and Harlem specifically during this time period and find a way to translate that to the screen on this smaller than usual budget that one would like to work with. But you found, in my opinion, some very unique ways to get around some of these challenges that were presented to you. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the filmmaking process of trying to do a period piece?
It's that sort of old adage of turn your misfortune into a strength or whatever it is, you know, it's like, you know, it forces a certain amount of creativity. But I will say that a lot of the ideas that I had about the story anyway sort of worked on a smaller budget. Like I counterintuitively did not want to make a noisy film. Everyone talks about the 1920s and there's a sort of assumption that it's loud because we use this phrase, the jazz age. So everything is blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And, you know, loud and exuberant and all the rest of it. And I didn't want to see Harlem like that. I wanted to see Harlem from the very narrow perspective of someone who's living a very claustrophobic existence. Mm-hmm. So instead you only see, you know, the sort of repetition of her domestic life. You only see this little patch of street because it's the only patch of street that she sees every day. So you only see it from one angle. You only see the inside of her house in as much as the repetition of the groceries and the thing and the falling asleep in the chair. And her house is sort of sparse and not really lived in. It doesn't actually look like a 1920s house because she's not entirely expressing her full self. So there's like not enough stuff on the wall. And also the movie is really literally quiet. Like the sound design was very purposefully that, because I do think this movie does require something of its audience. I think whatever you are dealing with around your own identity, whatever you were feeling, you bring to the movie, and you will work to get something from it. If you take it at face value, you're not going to get much because not very much happens. So in a way, the silence is a way of saying, I'm not going to tell you what to feel. You're going to have to work for it and lean in and pay attention.
And I love movies that make me do that, so I appreciate that greatly. One of the other things that I also wanted to ask you about here is working with the actors, of course, you being an actor as well. What is that like, and having that mindset of, oh my gosh, I can direct actors, like almost like the way I wish I was directed by others? Or like, just tell me a little bit about that collaborative process and being the one now and finally in that position.
Yeah, I suppose. I suppose the truth is there's no one size fits all. Like, I think that my father was a theater director, and he always had an uncanny ability to walk into a rehearsal room on the first day. I know this because I work with him. And he would just sort of wander around the room when everyone was having tea and chatting. And sort of, I could see him sort of like quietly taking in everyone's varying energies. And over time, I sort of worked out that what he was doing was trying to understand what everyone, the different needs of everyone in the room, because really the best directors work out what every individual actor needs in order to make them do their best work. Like, you're not going to make them do that. They're still doing it. You're never really controlling it, but you want them to feel supported, so they feel free to go there. And it was, so that sort of intuition and that kind of feeling thing is something that I think I brought to it. But also, it was pretty prescriptive because the subtext of this is so myriad. In a way, we had to all really work out very, very particularly and very specifically what was really going on underneath all the time at every given point. So I could capture it, so they could play it, so they could play it with each other. So we did rehearse and we did talk extensively and we did map things out. And also I had to be very prescriptive about the blocking, because the 4:3 aspect ratio meant, you know, and there was a lot of composed shots, like whether there are scenes with the two of them and Claire literally takes over Irene's shot when Irene leaves the frame, you know, very deliberate sort of signifiers and visual motifs that we had to work in. So I did have to say to them, look, this is a bit different. This is formal filmmaking, you know, mm-hmm. this is stylized and it's a little heightened. So I'm going to need you to stand in specific places. I'm giving you boundaries, just like everyone has boundaries in the film. Within those boundaries, I want you to feel free emotionally to do whatever you need to do. And I will help you do that. But I need you to stand on your mark, basically.
The ending of the movie is one that for me, first time I saw it, I've seen it twice now. And the first time I honestly did not know what I had just seen. And it was like playing tricks on me. Second time, it seemed a little bit more definitive. But the book, I think, is maybe more ambiguous. And I just want to know from your point of view, are you trying to be deliberate or are you trying to keep it ambiguous? Like, what is the intention here?
I'm somewhere between the two. And I think that what you said about the book is really interesting. Some people read the book and they're like, oh, it's obvious that she meant this. And other people are like, oh, it's so interesting the way she refuses to say what she means. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, that seems like the place to live in, you know, it's somewhere between the two. And actually, I do think pretty strongly that all of the things that could have happened did happen. Like, mm-hmm. everyone is responsible because overall society is responsible. I don't think the person who gets the horrible thing happened to them isn't being critiqued. It's the society that won't allow her to live.
That's great. I love that that's keeping in with the themes of the story as well. So bravo to you, because that ending is so, so powerful. I got to ask before we go, you know, obviously big, big fan of your work. And I love that you are experiencing this success with the movie. And finally, people are going to get a chance to see it on Netflix. So considering that it's been a long, long journey towards the release of this movie, I want to know, are you already thinking about what the next project will be with you as a director? Because there's such great, great talent on display here from you behind the camera.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I am.
Yeah, I love it. I am. Great, great. I'm sure you're not allowed to say necessarily, but I want.
No, it's nothing specific. Yeah, I haven't told mm-hmm. anyone about it, but I'm going to do it again.
Great. Are you looking to balance both directing and acting, or leaning one more towards the other?
I don't know. I think I'm just going to take it on a case by case basis. You know, mm-hmm. I don't feel the need to necessarily take jobs as an actor just because I like to be busy, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, of course.
Like, which I have done in the past, honestly. I think I'm just going to do a bit more. You know, I'll take an acting job if it really speaks to me, but otherwise I'm going to try and focus on directing.
Fantastic. Well, Rebecca, I really, really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me here today about your directorial debut, Passing, coming to Netflix on November 10th and in limited release on October 27th. And I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to my interview with the writer and director for Passing, Rebecca Hall, here on the Next Best Picture podcast. Passing is currently playing in theaters in limited release and streaming now on Netflix. You have been listening to the Next Best Picture podcast. We are proud to be part of the Evergreen Podcast Network, and you can subscribe to us anywhere where you subscribe to podcasts. Be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and let us know what you think of the show. We really appreciate your feedback and your support, which you can also lend on over at Patreon. For $1 minimum a month, you'll get some exclusive podcast content from us. Thank you so much for listening, as always, and we shall see you all next time.
Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.